Today is Wednesday. It's September 8th, 2021. It's 1:37 in the afternoon. Hi, this is John Williams. And this is the Missing Rascals podcast. Thanks for finding us. Share us with your friends. Give us a good rating. And listen for me weekdays from 9 to noon on WGN.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Brandon Pope from WCIU and Ebony Magazine.
I'm Heather Sharon from WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the editor and publisher of the Picayune Sentinel.
Wait a minute. Retired for just a couple of weeks, and now he's got a whole new job.
Well, it's a self-appointed job. But yes, I'm starting up my own little publication, and it's the first edition is going to come out tomorrow, because my thinking was that the world does not have enough journalists writing newsletters. So I'm going to try to rectify that situation. And I'm sort of trying to revive my old blog in a way, the spirit of my old blog. Blogs are dead, but newsletters are in, so that's what I'm going to be starting up.
So how do you subscribe? What do people do to get your stuff, Eric?
Well, they can write to me, Eric Zorn at Gmail. I'll put them on the list. And if you find it online, I'll put it on social media. You can just put your email address in there, and it's free, and I hope it's going to be fun. So
how often are you going to post?
Once a week. I'm going to do it on Thursdays so that I can talk about what we talked about on the Mincing Rascals and promote it.
Well, good on you, Eric. Your voice needs to be heard. I'm glad that are you itching to write again?
I am. As it turns out, yes, I had a really nice couple of months off, and there's all kinds of stuff I'd like to get into, and I miss it. I've been really enjoying the podcast, and I'm going to continue with that. But I like the clash of ideas and so on. So that's what I'm going to be aiming for.
Speaking of the clash of ideas, we are going to do this podcast on stage at the Tivoli Theater in Downers Grove on Saturday, October 30th at 10 in the morning. You can get tickets by going to WGNradio.com/TJ, as in Thomas Jefferson. I do an annual show where I interview this guy who comes out in character as Thomas Jefferson, and that does pretty well. But I think you guys have been sort of the boost for this thing. We've sold about 700 tickets in a week. The theater holds, I think, a little over 900 on the main floor. So if you want to come and look at all of us except Austin, sadly, will not be able to join us on stage.
His priorities are out of order.
I have a friend's wedding. It's a legit thing. It's not like my dog's sick.
So WGNradio.com/TJ, come watch us on stage and then stick around for the third president of the United States. Last time he was on stage with us in 2019, he talked about stuff like this.
I believe there will be one revolution after the next until everyone is treated identically in the law and everyone has a roughly equal opportunity at economic prosperity. But if you're saying, and I think I hear you saying, that women should vote, I'm against that. I think it's self-evident that, and I hope you will agree with me, that the tender breasts of ladies were not formed for political convulsion.
Just keeps getting better, doesn't it?
Much better that you smooth the feathers of your husbands returning ruffled from political debate. I said our American angels mistake themselves much if they wish to pursue the French Amazons into the public arena. No, ladies, your happiness, if you only know to recognize it, resides in the nursery. I sense agreement. This is how we saw it. Abigail Adams wrote that famous letter to her husband. You know that letter? So we're about to declare independency, and John Adams is the key figure by far. And we're at the Second Continental Congress, and she's back at Braintree, and so he's in Philadelphia. And so she writes him this letter and says, I long to hear that you have declared an independency. And when you do, I hope that you will remember the ladies. And she says, do not be tyrants. All men would be tyrants if they could. But if you don't attend to the rights of women, we ladies are determined to foment our own rebellion.
Okay. Should the Chicago City Council members get a raise? The top earners among the 50 ward representatives come in at about $123,000 a year. Eric pointed out that's $25,000 more than they made in 2006. The peak then was about $98,000 a year. So up 25 grand, 123.5. It's hard for me to say if the council or any individual member's doing a good job. How do you calculate the merit for somebody like this? About the jobs, though, I always say, what is that responsibility worth? How much should that job pay? And for what they're in charge of, I don't think 124 grand is an unreasonable place to start. Austin, what's your take on raises for members of the Chicago City Council?
Guess my take.
Yeah.
Guess my take. Like, so every job that I've worked at, you have to justify a raise. So I do think there should be a bunch of arguments from aldermen. Every alderman should go on record and say why they personally deserve a raise, and their constituents can decide whether or not that's a worthy explanation. I think if they want a raise, they should do something to deserve it. I would suggest two options. One would be cut the number of aldermen, so it's revenue neutral. If you cut city council by a third, we'd be closer to the national average. That would also help with all of the ticky-tack aldermanic prerogative stuff that we talk about, that aldermen can do because their wards are so small. In Los Angeles, where you have 250,000 constituents per council member, they can't worry themselves with sidewalk cafe permits and licensing and permits, things of that nature. It's too much. That would be one option. The second option would be, I would call this the pizza party approach. If you go 3 years without an indictment in city council, then you can get a raise.
Well, then no one would ever get a raise.
Well, they wouldn't deserve one.
Being an alderman is supposed to be a part-time job, that every alderman is allowed to seek outside employment, and most of them do. So that includes your favorite alderman and mine, Ed Burke, who worked as a private tax attorney and is under indictment in regards to the intersection of his public job and his private job. He has pled not guilty, of course. And I think that if you want to talk about pay raises, you also have to think about what are they earning in a second job and what sort of hours are they spending doing the public work. And I don't think that we as a city sort of understand that, that this is supposed to be a part-time job. It's supposed to be a part-time legislature. Alderman Marty Quinn, who is probably one of the aldermen who has the best attendance at meetings and works most consistently on issues involving his ward, is the lowest paid alderman because he has not taken the pay raises over a series of years. Do I think it makes more sense to have a debate over whether our aldermen should be allowed to seek outside employment when they're in such a powerful position? I think that's probably a more important debate to be having.
I definitely agree with that. Yeah, I think that the outside employment is a really interesting issue. In truth, that some of these aldermen who do work really hard for their constituents, it is a full-time job. I know it's not supposed to be, but it's become one. They represent, 55,000 people right. each, more or less?
Right.
That's the size of a fairly large suburb, right? I mean, that's a big job that you're managing a lot of different responsibilities for. And the principle behind this pay raise or the engine behind the pay raise is sort of an automatic inflation adjuster. Am I right, Heather, that they,
right.
they put that in so they didn't have to vote for pay raises, that it kicks in automatically?
Right. Now, they can opt out, and all they have to do is to send a letter to the clerk saying, I don't want the pay raise. It's tied to the cost of living. It's tied to inflation, which means that it's going to be bigger this year than it has been in years past because inflation is greater.
Is the raise we're talking about just an inflation rider?
It's actually lower. I mean, I looked at an online inflation calculator, and the $98,125 of the top earners on the council made in 2006 would equal about $132,000 today. And we're talking about a boost up to about $123,000. So it isn't. I mean, if you accept the principle of standard of cost of living raises and you accept the salary they had before, does not seem to me to be an unreasonable rate of increase. And one other point that I'd like to make is that I think it is important to pay legislators and so on for the responsibility that they have. It is kind of a principle of business. People say they want government to run like a business. Well, people in business – the people who have responsibility, who have to make tough decisions, who are put upon at all hours of the day and night to put out fires, literal and figurative, get paid a lot of money, and in most cases, way more money than aldermen are making. Someone who is running a corporation with 55,000 people is going to make millions and millions of dollars a year, not 128,000. So the amount of money doesn't seem unreasonable, and the raise doesn't seem unreasonable.
It's probably the politically smart move, though, in this time to probably decline it if you're one of these aldermen who is well off or you have a job, a side job that you're doing pretty well at, because there are a lot of Chicagoans right now that are struggling. And the optics there, it probably benefits you more politically to say, you know, I'm going to take a stand here and say no to it. However, I'm with Eric, though. This is it essentially should be a full-time job if you're going to be an alderman, right? You should be full-time committed to, being the representative of your ward, addressing its issues. And really, it should be almost a 24/7 job. Just like you're basically the mayor of your neighborhood. And that calls on you to work weekends and work hours you don't want to. So it's a tough job for sure. Just in this time where people are struggling, I think it makes sense. You might want to say, I'll hold off this time around.
To the extent, though, that they're being paid the proper amount or that the raise is proper, it's being paid for the wrong job. These jobs could be done. 80-90% of their work could be done by sort of like what the ward superintendent does now. It's people taking service requests. The things that they're voting on overwhelmingly are not issues of citywide importance. They are ticky-tack things in their wards. And I don't think it's good to be paying people who are responsible for that this much and constantly giving them raises.
This probably would only make it worse, Austin, but how about if we let your constituents vote on your raise? But then it would be more about the micromanagement and not the big picture stuff you always want them to be tending to, right?
Yeah. I mean, what you should think about it like if there were 50 people in the mayor's office or in a city department who are responsible for most of what aldermen end up being responsible for, how much should those people be paid? And you should hire those people in those departments rather than having your.
Yeah, but I think those jobs would be north of 125 grand probably too, don't you think?
They may be, and they could bargain just like other city employees bargain.
If you paid a member of Congress what the job was worth, you know, commensurate with the responsibility, you'd pay them millions of dollars each. So I suppose at some point my logic here doesn't make any sense, but I think what we're asking these people to do, govern this city. Let me put it this way. How good a job do you think the city council does? I don't know, Heather, is there no way to, does anybody independently score that?
No, I mean, I think that this gets sort of at the root of something that I try pretty consistently and feel like I fail at writing about, in that for decades under Richard J. Daley and Richard M. Daley, the city council was essentially, as Austin says, they were glorified ward superintendents elected on their basis of their community ties and their ability to protect and serve the residents of that ward. They were not elected traditionally to be legislators. They were not really elected to make citywide policy. If that's what you want from an alderman, it makes sense to pay them commensurate with it being a part-time job. I don't know that that's what aldermen do today. I think some of them do and some of them don't. And I think some of them who want to legislate and make policy citywide are very frustrated with the system. But I also think that if that's what you want from a city council, you have to consider restricting outside employment, because we've seen time and time again, that's where these corruption cases come from. And if it's not that, then it's the aldermanic prerogative.
Yeah.
And if you don't have aldermanic prerogative, then that means that you've got a citywide city council making citywide policy as opposed to 50 people making policy for 50 wards. So this sort of is in a way sort of a debate about what we as Chicagoans want the city council to be. And right now it's sort of like we've got the exoskeleton of a 19th century or 20th century city council that's sort of jammed up against 21st century reality and responsibilities. And there's a lot of conflict there.
Austin is making the point that I think that supports the idea of a reduced size city council. Like you could have far fewer council people, as you do in Los Angeles, and have more bureaucrats taking care of signage and things like that. Another thing, though, is that I think that you want to have a situation where you don't have to be independently wealthy to be a legislator or a councilman, that you want to pay them enough so that it's not just this sort of side hustle where only people who already make a good buck can afford to be a legislator. So there is some balance in there. What should we pay them? And it's a good debate to have, I think. And it's a good debate. And the size of the legislature, and when you have people who are essentially part-time lawmakers who are not in Springfield or not in council for weeks and months at a time, then you do have to ask yourself, okay, what are we paying for? What are we getting for our dollars here?
Yeah. Well, if Austin were here, I think he would say, okay, reduce it to 20 members, eliminate outside income, pay him $200,000 a year.
I would take that deal. I think actually 20 might be too low. I think if we cut in half to a third, we'd be about national average in terms of constituents per council member. To the point of people's approval, the Chicago Index, which Crane's put on with a couple of other organizations, has had some methodological problems, put their approval rating at, I think, 7%. 7% of people thought city council was doing a good job, according to that. And
wow.
So in any event, the automatic increase creates real problems, I think, for accountability. And lawmakers should be forced to vote on those things, just like they vote on lots of other budget items. And maybe you tie it to citywide approval. Hmm. If the council's doing a good job, you get a raise.
Speaking of salaries, David Brown, the city's police superintendent, makes $260,000 a year. After another weekend of violence in the city, Brown spoke about the death of a four-year-old who was visiting Chicago and suggested that many of the child victims are around bad adults who are the intended targets or are sometimes the shooters themselves.
It's always some other offender, gang member, criminal network, some beef, and they're targeting some adult, and young people are nearby, and they are shot as innocent bystanders.
Brown himself said that there are members of his own family that he won't associate with because of their criminal past or ties.
And I have family members that I don't invite over for family gatherings just because of some of the issues that come with that family member that is living a life of crime. I don't want to bring into my home. And I would just not, in a condescending way, encourage you as a family to protect your children from people in the family that are on the wrong side of the law.
Spoken like a guy from Dallas. It's kind of callous, I think, to tell the numerous too many families who have had children lost to gun violence in the city that it was essentially their fault. That's basically what he's saying. He's making a large overassumption in assuming that just because these kids got shot in a neighborhood, well, I guess the parent must have known somebody. There must have been some sort of gang connection, whatever. He's jumping to a lot of conclusions here. When the reality is, unfortunately and tragically, a lot of these shootings happen not because these kids are being targeted, but because they are casualties of just this lack of empathy going around in these neighborhoods. People now are just out here shooting bullets, spraying bullets in neighborhoods with a target that may not even be associated with someone who's connected to that kid. So for him to say a comment like that, I think is really disrespectful to a lot of families in Chicago and just kind of shows the disconnect he still has with the city that he's, you know, charged to serve and protect.
That sort of took my breath away when I heard it, because we've heard time and again, when Black and Latino kids have been killed, there's this sort of push to figure out, like, who was at fault? And you don't see that same kind of push when you have a white kid who is, you know, caught up in the gang life or something happens. Like, we do not hear for this call for parental responsibility when it's a white child. We just don't. David Brown's son was killed because of his involvement in the drug trade. So does that make David Brown like a bad person not to be let around their kids? I mean, it just is a reductive approach to public safety when it is so much more comprehensive than just keeping, you know, your kids sketchy uncle away from you, because that's just not a public safety strategy. It made me remember when, after the Laquan McDonald tape was released, Rahm Emanuel was going to give this big speech where it was going to be about public safety and it was going to be about sort of his approach forward. And before the speech, it leaked that he was going to address the need for more parental responsibility. And he was basically warned by everybody involved that if he did that, that he would be, you know, just he would be destroying any chance he had for a third term in office. And he didn't do that because he was convinced that it was politically tone deaf. I don't know how we're sitting here in 2021 and we have a police superintendent who's basically echoing something that was considered so out of the pale in 2015 that the mayor couldn't say it.
But it was considered out of the pale for political reasons. David Brown didn't say that for public safety reasons. He said it for personal safety reasons.
I think it's very political.
It will be political because he's a public figure, but just as a pragmatic thing, he was saying that if the bullets are intended, and maybe Brandon, I don't know what the numbers are. I mean, do any of us, but if that child is in the company of adults who are themselves involved in some of these crimes, then yeah, that kid's in the way. And yeah, those adults have a responsibility to safeguard the kid.
And we certainly heard this argument advanced back in April when Jocelyn Adams, the 7-year-old girl, was shot in the McDonald's drive-thru, and her father, who was gang-affiliated, was ostensibly the target. She was shot and killed, and a lot of people were saying, well, what is this guy, what is this father doing driving around the city when he knows or ought to know that he's going to be a target of this kind of violence? That was a little bit more of a focused criticism here. I think that Brandon makes an excellent point that you end up when you speak in broad generalities like that, you really end up blaming a lot of grieving families for being the victims of often random kind of gunfire. I don't think anyone was even we don't know the details exactly behind the shooting of the 4-year-old. Right?
No, but he made it sound as though this girl was in the wrong house. And we don't know that. There's been no reporting that the people in that house were gang members.
Let's take a step back and sort of look at where David Brown is right now. He's been in office for like a year and a half. He started and promised fewer than 300 murders per year. That didn't happen. We've now had more murders in 2021 at this point than we had in all of 2020, which was a historically violent year. So my spidey sense as a reporter is when a public official starts saying, hey, it's that person's fault, it means that they're trying to say, hey, look at the sparkly thing over there, as opposed to sort of focusing on what I've been able to do and what I haven't been able to do. And there's been a lot of criticism of the way that David Brown has rearranged the police department. He's formed these citywide task forces that have pulled officers out of the districts and off of beats to sort of address crime in a way that Chicago has periodically tried and then stopped and then tried again. So, you know, he obviously doesn't have any control over individual people's decisions to commit crimes or associate with people who commit crimes. He can't control that. He can control how the Chicago Police Department is deployed and what they do. I think it's telling that he's not focused on the things that he can control and is instead trying to make some sort of cultural argument, which I say again has been used to criticize the choices of Black and Latino Chicagoans in a way that white Chicagoans do not confront.
And I'll take it a step further here. David Brown is a Black man. He mentions he's got family members who he doesn't hang around or whatever, but I'm sure he's got family members as well who may not have the cleanest resume, may not have the most sparkling background, but they're still family. Anybody remember when Bill Cosby made that like pound cake speech? Yeah.
Pull up your pants and solve everything, right, Brandon?
Yeah. Pull up your pants to solve everything, right? You know, it's all about you.
People getting shot in the back of the head over a piece of pound cake. And then we all run out and we're outraged. Oh, the cop shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand? Brown versus the Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We've got to take the neighborhood back.
That's the vibes I got here. It just feels very like, you know, this is your own doing. Well, You hang around these people, this is what you get. And that's not what a police chief should be saying, especially a black police chief in a city with a high black population. It just, it was so tone deaf. I just, when I saw it, I just had, I was shocked. I didn't expect this from David Brown. Having interviewed him, having talked to him, I just didn't comprehend he would even have something like that come out of his mouth. And I can only imagine what a parent right now is thinking who, their kid didn't die because of this. They didn't die because they knew the person who was the shooter. A lot of these are random shootings. You can't really just do a blanket statement like that. If you're talking about this case in particular, then say that, right? But him to just generalize like that was a huge mistake, huge mistake. He may have information, though, with this case in particular that we don't have. So if he's talking about the specific case, okay, cool. Make that point for that case. Don't talk about all parents. Don't talk about anyone who's losing a kid. It's just not the, you're not going to win that one.
It struck me as someone who continues to fail at their job and their manager brings them in and they say, yeah, you keep missing your sales targets. And then they're like, well, yeah, I had a lot of trauma as a kid. And really the, you know, capitalism and the patriarchy are really oppressing me. And it's really been difficult for me to hit my sales targets this month. When you start talking about systemic issues, it's, no pun intended, a cop-out for the police to do. It's very important to have conversations about root causes of crime, personal responsibility, cultural issues should all be fair game, and people should openly talk about that. The police are responsible for the police, and they have a very detailed work plan to improve policing in the city that they continue to flunk. And they should focus on improving that if they care about public safety.
Well, I thought that David Brown was talking about personal culpability. Culpability is the wrong word. I thought David Brown was talking about personal responsibility. And yeah, so maybe the police aren't the people to say that because they should be safeguarding the whole city institutionally. But does somebody get to say that? Does somebody get to at least make the point? Who gets to say, what are you as individuals, what are we as individuals doing to better safeguard our kids, either by taking them out of the window in a neighborhood where bullets are flying, or don't be involved in gangs? Does anybody get to say that?
I think it's important for people to say that. And there's been culture, like Barack Obama talked a lot about fatherlessness and single parent homes and the effects of that. Like, these are important conversations. One, it's tone deaf to have it after right after a kid is killed. To Brandon's point, like, that's just absurd. And second, it's hard to take it at face value when there's just a pile of missing work, you know, sitting right behind the person that could improve things.
A pile of missing work, meaning policies that they could enact, policies they could enact that would do the things he's talking about. But he
had an analogy, a list of papers with red X's saying missed deadline behind.
Well, he's already a police superintendent, right? People don't want to feel like they're being policed for their personal choices, though. And if you hold a policing position, it's probably not a good idea to start policing people's personal choices. Leave it to a pastor, a community leader, even a politician. But David Brown, this was not the time or place. Even if you are going to do a commentary like that, like, maybe save it for a time that's not after a tragedy. Like, yeah. Just he went the wrong direction for me. It just wasn't a good look, I don't think.
Yeah, the timing did not seem smart to me, but there is an issue that he's pointing at, which is that when you are involved in gang culture, in the culture of criminality, that you are exposing more than just yourself to harm. And this is something to think about when you are getting into a life of gangs and crime and drugs and all that stuff, that you do put your family at risk because of the way violence is being perpetrated these days. I don't think that's a bad point to make. And I don't think it's a good, I think it's something you can say that might make people think twice about the impact of what they are doing on not just strangers on the street, but on their own family. That's not a bad thought to put in somebody's mind. But as Brandon points out, to say it as a reflection on this particular crime without any sort of backup, it strikes me as very tone deaf, and compounding the grief of this family. The little boy sounds like a wonderful little boy, and he's just getting his hair braided in his living room. Sometimes you hear about, you know, kids who are or people who are just, they seem to be out at a strange time of night or something. He was in his house. It was and having his hair braided.
Here's the way I heard it: a very frustrated man who's dealt with some of this shit himself, and he said, as a caveat, I'm just going to speak personally here, and then maybe he said the right thing at the wrong time or the wrong thing at the wrong time, but I wasn't as offended maybe by even the timing of what he was saying is what he was saying.
We have seen time and time again that we as a society look for explanations for these inexplicable bursts of violence, right? And some of the way we do that is we tend to separate victims into good victims and to bad victims. And I am deeply uncomfortable with the way that our city and our news media does that. Because if this like 4-year-old had been a holy terror who did not listen to his parents and hated having his hair braided, his death would be no less a tragedy than it is that he was.
No, but that's not what David, but David Brown's not saying that, but that's not what David Brown is saying.
Let me finish. So when we try to separate the victims into good victims and bad victims, and we somehow seek to sort of make those bad victims somehow culpable or at least complicit in the violence and potentially even in their own deaths, I think we play into that notion that we have a greater sort of control over these issues than we do. And I think what David Brown was explicitly saying, that if you make the right decisions, if you live the way that we tell you to, we will honor you. We will see you as a good victim. And I think that's just so incredibly damaging.
I just didn't hear him saying you're a bad victim. I heard him say you won't be a victim, but I think I'm 4-1 on this. And Eric.
Hey, man, I mean, overall, I mean, we're all going to interpret things differently, right? In the end, I just hope David Brown, I'd like to see him comment more about why people join gangs. I'd like to see him comment more about why he thinks that is. Why are people choosing gangs as an option? Mm-hmm. Why do they see that as their only option? And how can we, as a police institution, work to change that? That's kind of the personal responsibility commentary I look to hear from the police superintendent. How can I fix the gang issue? Not so much wagging the finger at the parents or family members involved. I hope that he's able to look back at this and learn from how some may have taken it.
Two more things to talk about outside of the state. One, I wanted to ask you guys about what happened in Texas, or what the Supreme Court allowed to continue or start to happen in Texas, and also about 9/11, 20 years later. What are some of your preeminent thoughts today? But before we get to that, let's just do the one last thing on my docket for the state of Illinois. Secretary of State frontrunner Alexei Giuliani.
I think you mixed two of the topics together. 9/11 and Secretary of State.
Yeah, Giuliani and Janulius. This is where editing is going to make us all sound so much smarter. Go ahead, John. Start again.
Eric, why don't you do the setup?
Secretary of State frontrunner Alexei Janulius said Illinoisans could take multiple photos for their driver's licenses if they're willing to pay a little extra for it, or they might even be able to bring in their own photo to use on their driver's license, because we all would like to have little, maybe glam photos of ourselves when we're presenting our driver's license to clerks and others who want to see our license. So he wants to offer this as an option for people. I guess you pay what, an extra $10 per photo. You take a photo, you don't like it, you get another one. As I remember, the last time I had this done, I think you were allowed to take two, right? They took two and you chose one, or am I just misremembering that? It's a great idea. It's kind of like vanity license plates, right? The state makes a little extra money.
Seems like the same thing. Although he says the money should go to safe driver programs or something. I think anytime you can scratch a little money out of the people in the state of Illinois, just put it towards, I don't know, the debt or the – don't create a new way to spend the money. Send it to the place where we've already spent the money. I'm all for it. I'd pay $15 for a better picture of me. I am not photogenic.
Hey, it might take me 50. I get it. I mean, hey, we've all been there where we're like, hey, that picture ain't the best at all. My pictures are never the best. I just took a passport photo. And I didn't have my hair cut. The beard was dry. My eyes were crusty. And I got to keep that thing for what? 10 years?
Yeah.
10 years? Yeah. Let me get a redo. We can do redos. I'm always for that.
But think how youthful you'll look when you flash it in 10 years.
I hope so, man.
But on those passport photos, you do get to take that. Oh, no, you go to like a Walgreens or whatever. They stand you there. They take the picture for you, right? I guess you don't have much control over that.
You don't.
I think you get a choice. You think you get some choice in those. But here's a bigger question.
Maybe all of Brandon's were terrible. Go ahead, Eric.
All seven.
It seems to me that in this day when credit cards are used for almost everything, that I don't flash my driver's license nearly as much as I used to back when we used to write checks and so on. I can't remember the last time I had to produce my driver's license and someone looked at it and looked at me to make sure I was myself. So I'm not sure that it makes that much difference anymore what your driver's license picture looks like.
You haven't bought alcohol lately?
John, I'm 63 years old. I'm not going to get carded. Okay?
I got carded. I'm not much younger than you, and I'm about the same age as you. What am I, 61? I got carded the other day because I think that the clerk knows there's a video of them, and I'm buying the alcohol, and everybody gets carded. So they look at it to demonstrate they're looking at it, but they don't scrutinize it because obviously I'm not 20 years old.
Yeah, I was carded when I go to the Intertown pub to play music. They say everyone's got to show an ID.
Yeah.
And I would hand the guy at the door the ID, and he wouldn't even look at it. I felt very insulted. He was taking and handed back to me like, yeah, old timer, go on in.
Well, I was behind a guy who was about 70, and they said, can we see your ID? And he didn't have his ID with him. And they said, we can't sell you alcohol. And he goes, look at me. I'm 70 years old. And they said, our policy is you got to have an ID to buy booze. And he had a long conversation with him and lost and stormed out of there. They wouldn't sell him the alcohol.
You should have done what I did in high school and just go out on the sidewalk and have someone go in and buy it for you.
Yeah, find right. A 20-year-old out on the street and they'll go in and buy it for you.
I'm just glad that Giannoulias is talking about responsibilities that the Secretary of State's office actually has instead of talking about like election stuff and ballot access and things like that, which has been his campaign so far. I would say I'm a single issue voter on the Secretary of State, and it's fix the wait times. And then I would put a 1B, implement employee performance reviews that take into account customer experience at the DMV.
Do you have a bad?
If you do those two things, you'll have my vote for the rest of my life. You also have to have a tumbling squat. That's, I guess, I'm a two-issue voter.
A tumbling squat is in the Jesse White tumblers.
I believe Giannoulias has addressed or is trying to address the wait time issues by instituting a program where you can make an appointment. Or is that something Jesse White has done? You go online and make an appointment, so you don't have to go and stand in one of those really long lines. Maybe that will be a moot issue by the time the election rolls around.
I don't understand why they were closed as much as they were during the pandemic, though. I mean, other things were opening up, and those employees were still getting paid, and they weren't answering the phones. And that was a long time.
I thought it was interesting that Pat Dowell, who's also running for Secretary of State, put out a press release saying this was a terrible idea and that instead Illinois should be focused on issuing digital driver's licenses so that we can all carry it on our phone and that we don't have to deal with that card, which, of course, you know, we can lose and whatnot. And I think that it sets up an interesting sort of potential conflict between Dowell and Giannoulias, you know, Dowell going for the, well, let's do things that she thinks actually will help Illinois residents. And this from Giannoulias seems a very clear sort of let's play to people's vanity and get money from them sort of thing, as opposed to like, let's make the system of government work better, which I think is what Dowell is trying to present herself as the champion of. I remain somewhat surprised that race hasn't been a bigger issue in this race, because, you know, Jesse White is one of just the lions of Black political power in Illinois. And the fact that nobody's really talking about the fact that the two of the three leading candidates to replace him are not Black, with, you know, Alexi Giannoulias and Anna Valencia, the city clerk of Chicago. And I think that would be an understated sort of sea change in Illinois politics. Of course, Giannoulias lost his Senate race to Mark Kirk several years ago after sort of being tagged as sort of a lightweight. I don't know that saying, hey, I'll let you pick your driver's license picture sort of address that lack of substance, which has been a frequent criticism.
Doesn't make it a bad idea. I like both ideas, but I think, yes. I take your point, Heather. I think the second one is probably a better use of the power of that office.
Yeah, well, you can certainly make a both and argument for having a digital driver's license with multiple photo opportunities for it, because a digital driver's license might be something that you would flash more often if it were easy to do, or it might be something that you would scan and it would show up on somebody's screen, a cashier's screen, or something like that. I don't know. You know, Anna Valencia, of course, is a woman of color. So you've got and Pat Dowell and Janulius. And I think a lot of people are in the Austin Berg camp with the Secretary of State, which is like, don't talk to me about labor issues and you know, abortion rights and all this other stuff. I want to get my driver's license and my license plates and my stickers, and I want them to be delivered on time. I don't want to stand around your offices for hours where they call out these obscure bingo numbers as you wait for your turn. So I think that may be where it's going to come down to, is which one of these candidates is going to project the air of competence, not of political viability. I don't want someone becoming Secretary of State who just sees it as a stepping stone, you know, like, mm-hmm. like George Ryan and Jim Edgar. They all just wanted to be Secretary of State because they wanted to have an office. And I want someone who's really committed to making the Secretary of State's office a really good.
Yeah, but who grows up?
Yeah,
who grows?
It should be the biggest nerd. It should be the biggest nerd should win.
That's it.
Not a politician.
Who grows up wanting to be Secretary of State of Illinois someday? But whoever that is should get our vote,
Pat
right?
Pat Dowell is making that explicit promise. She says, this isn't a stepping stone. I won't run for anything else. And, you know, of course, Janulius has spent the last decade or so in the wilderness after being state treasurer and sort of tapped by the Obama world to sort of for greater things that he never quite capitalized. So I think that's a question he's going to also have to answer.
Here's what I'll run for that office, and I'm going to let you pick your QR code and make it the prettiest QR code. I don't know how that technology works. Do you guys?
The easiest way I had it explained to me was that it is a shortcut to a website.
I used them more this in the past year than I'd ever used them in my life by a lot.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
They're restaurants now. They give you the little piece of paper with the thing, and you're not even supposed to touch the piece of paper. Then you scan it, and the menu's on your phone. That's where it's really come in handy. So,
yeah, I think they came out over a decade ago.
Yeah,
really?
But I've never used them before that. I would never use them before.
Let's talk briefly about Texas's law, which was passed in the spring and enacted in the 1st of September. A woman will not be eligible for an abortion after 6 weeks. And if you suspect somebody is aiding and abetting that abortion in any way, you can even anonymously tell on them and collect a $10,000 bounty. Some people are calling it the Texas Taliban. I was shocked by pretty much all of this. I hadn't been paying that much attention to it anyway, but the Supreme Court passed on it. So this law is now the law in Texas.
The Supreme Court really, they passed on it, but they didn't, even in not hearing it, they opened the door. So they're going to revisit the constitutionality of it. They're going to revisit this law. I'm surprised they let it go through as far as it did. I think that every citizen of every political stripe ought to be dismayed by this idea that we're essentially deputizing anybody in the world to be a vigilante, be an abortion vigilante. And it was a strange end run around Roe v. Wade.
Which is what it had to be.
I think it does not bode well for Roe v. Wade. I was appalled by the law. I'm appalled by the 6 week limit. There are women who don't know they're pregnant at 6 weeks.
Most women don't know that they are pregnant at 6 weeks.
And there's no exceptions here for rape and incest, which I think is barbaric. I mean, you know, we can get into the whole abortion debate if we want. And I'm very, very much pro-abortion rights. So that's where I come down on this. That's how I see this, which is just as an appalling overreach of the government. And that's where I am on it.
Well, the logic to me works like this if you're on the side of the legislation, and that is if you believe that a conception is a human life and that abortion is always killing that person, you can't tolerate that. If you're that absolute about it, then yeah, you deputize anybody in the world to keep somebody from killing that person. And yeah, you don't allow an exception in any case because that's a person now. That's the logic of it.
I would caution the conservatives, though, that take that moral righteousness, that sort of stand on this issue, because if that end around that Eric is describing is successful in the long run, there are many other issues conservatives care about that then become on the table for the same thing. Like, so if you're in a state that has a really anti-Second Amendment legislature and they want to ban handguns in the home, which is also a complete violation of precedent, but you're going to place the state beyond reach by outsourcing enforcement to a private band of gun control activists, That is not a future conservatives want. And you should be concerned by this law, if not for any other reason, for that reason.
That's the first thing an attorney told me when it came up on the show. He said, okay, you've just now given the mechanism for all kinds of things beyond right to life issues. Are you guys suggesting that, in fact, this whole scheme is going to be found unconstitutional in some way, or that somehow this isn't going to stick?
I would suspect that the scheme itself will be found unconstitutional. Heather indicated that she feels, and I agree, that the court is going to revisit at least that part of it.
What is happening is that there's a case before the Fifth Circuit of Appeals that was brought to stop this law from going into effect. Now that it isn't in effect, it will go back to those lower courts for a full sort of evidentiary hearing on the merits of the law. However, I think that if you think that there are five votes on the Supreme Court to uphold Roe versus Wade, I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I would like to sell you.
Yeah, and Abbott's really screwing over Texas here by even pushing this. And he made these ridiculous comments about ending rape.
We're going to eliminate the rapists, he says.
We're going to eliminate the rapists. How are you going to do that, Greg Abbott? It's wild to me when I see governors miss the big picture. Even if you are, you know, anti-abortion, what big entity, like the NBA, NFL, what league, what big-time corporation is going to want to do business with your state when you have something so hot-button like this? That's so divisive, rippling through. We saw what happened in North Carolina when they, had this transgender bill. You saw the NBA pull out of their all-star game immediately. And I think you're going to see a similar ripple effect in Texas, a state that a lot of its economy is fueled off tourism, is fueled off events happening in that state. You put something like there here, you're cutting off a lot of money for your state by even taking this strong of a stance. So even beyond just how vile it is, it's wild to me that a governor would risk the whole livelihood of their state based off of this. It's ridiculous.
Well, I wonder, because Florida has signaled its intention to follow suit and have a similar law. And if you have enough large states, I mean, North Carolina is small compared to Florida and True. Texas. And so it's a lot easier to boycott North Carolina than it would be to boycott Texas and Florida at the same time. So I don't know how effective such a thing would be. Certainly people have talked about it, and you'd like to think that some of that would come into play. But I mean, there's also talk about boycotting Georgia, right? Not going to Georgia because of if they enact those voting restrictions. So it's an interesting tactic, and one that you hope, I mean, you sort of hope that the center begins to hold on some of these issues.
Well, does it make you, Eric, want to boycott Texas yourself? I mean, you can do that. I think a lot of us go, screw it, I'm done with Texas. If that's who you are, that's not who I am. I won't spend any money there.
I'm pleased not to mess with Texas any longer.
But it is kind of intriguing, isn't it? Sort of the self-determination of states. If Texas isn't Illinois, it sure as hell ain't Chicago. So if that's how you all want to live your lives, constitutionality notwithstanding, if that's who you are as a people, it's too bad we're a union of 50 states because it trickles down to the rest of us. But Texas gets to be Texas, even though that didn't even reflect the views of Texas, but it does of their Republican-controlled legislature. So
let me make this point: that women in Texas will always be able to get abortions as long as they've got money. That this kind of legislation really impacts women who don't have means. That if you're a upper middle class woman in Texas and you get pregnant, and you want to end your pregnancy, you can fly to Illinois, right? You can fly to California. You can fly where things are. These kind of laws are going to really impact people at the lower end of the socioeconomic strata much, much more than people who are of privilege. And that's something that I think needs to be talked about, which is the real impact of these laws, who it's going to affect.
And it's just so creepy to think that the Uber driver or somebody overhears you at the grocery store could go, hey, there's $10,000 right there. It's hard to believe that's really going to happen, but I suppose at some point it's going to happen, and then somebody's going to challenge it for that.
Even if it doesn't happen, that it's already had the desired effect in making people worry that could happen. happen, that they're making themselves liable.
It remains to be seen which sleeping giant this legislation is going to awaken. It's long been something that frustrates me about the political left, is that it just can't get its voting act together and mobilize the majority of the public that believes that abortion should be allowed, certainly through the first trimester, generally, up to 20 weeks. Most Americans support Roe v. Wade, if you ask them in polls, and yet they don't rush out and vote on that issue. And this may awaken a great number of people who are maybe otherwise comfortable with certain Republican philosophies to say, this has gone way too far. This party is, as John put it, the Taliban of Texas here. And we can't support that. On the other hand, it may really encourage people who are opposed to abortion rights, who think that they've now got this, the end of Roe v. Wade is in sight. And the end of Roe v. Wade is not the end of their goal. The end of Roe v. Wade just opens the door to outlawing abortion in state after state after state. And that will be their next goal once they get rid of Roe.
And it would be the efficacy of Roe v. Wade, right? I mean, they didn't comment. This isn't about Roe v. Wade in a way, right? It's this end around we're talking about.
You're sort of buying into what the creators of this law want you to think. They want you to think, oh, we're not touching Roe versus Wade. It's there. We're just sort of carving out this sort of exception to Roe versus Wade. But Roe versus Wade guarantees a woman the right to an abortion before viability, which is somewhere around 20 weeks, somewhere around there. If a woman in the state of Texas who is 7 weeks pregnant cannot get an abortion, that is a violation of Roe versus Wade. And that is the state of affairs right now.
Just one more point. There is a Mississippi case coming up, I believe, that is much more on point about abortion that the court is going to hear and rule on prior to the 2022 election, that really is going to say, I forget the details of that restriction, but is it 15 weeks or something like that? But anyway,
it's a so-called heartbeat law that if you can detect a so-called heartbeat of the baby, that Roe versus Wade is no longer applicable at that point.
I yield the balance of my time to John Williams.
Today's September 8th. September 11th, 20 years later. I just wondered if you guys had any thoughts that were on your mind this week that you wanted to share. I watched the Frontline piece about how we got from – it was an interesting movie that Frontline did about what happened on 9/11 20 years ago. And they drew the line to January 6th. And they talked about the administration's involvement and roles and everything that happened after the World Trade Towers were attacked and the Pentagon and so forth. But then they kind of said, and that's how we got to January 6th and Donald Trump. We don't normally process it in those terms, but there they did. The biggest takeaway for me was just following how the various administrations handled it over the years. And as I was watching some of these seminal moments over the last 20 years, particularly relative to Afghanistan, I found myself getting really angry at Donald Rumsfeld all over again, which is something I hadn't had to process in a very long time. And I'll be happy if 20 years go by and I don't think about him again.
This was one of those events. You know, I was, not to make anyone feel old, I was in fourth grade when this happened. I was young and I remember being picked up from school. My mom, I didn't know what was going on. My mom said, it's time to go. I'll explain to you later. A lot of kids were getting picked up from school. I remember hearing that the sonic boom, in a sense, that happened a little bit after. And I remember seeing those shocking images of people jumping from the towers. And at a young age, that image, seeing those images on the news, that stuck with me. And hearing the stories of people as the days went on, the weeks, the months, and the years, of the heroism of the people that, you know, did what they could to help whoever they could inside the towers as they were falling. It's a moment that changed, I think, a lot of people's lives, a lot of our lives. And I hope that we never forget, one, what that day was, but also the sense of coming together that happened in that moment, right? Because I felt it as a young person, and I still feel it today. And when I read these stories, like one of my favorite stories ever from that day is the man in the red bandana, a kid who was a relative unknown, played Division IV hockey, And he jumped and took the call to action, put on a red bandana and shuffled people out of harm's way in the towers, lost his life in the process. But numerous people can tell you they remember seeing a man in a red bandana escorting them out of the towers and into safety. So thinking about those moments, thinking about the times we came together, I hope we never lose sight of that. And I hope it doesn't take another tragedy for us to reclaim that sense of, you know, unity and Americanism and coming together.
Yeah, there was a poll taken in 2002 and 55%, maybe a year after the 9/11 attacks, 55% of the people said the country had changed for the better because of the attacks. 22% said it was for the worse. They replicated that poll just recently, and now only 33% of people say that 9/11 changed the country for the better, and 46% say it made the country worse. I would fall into the camp that it didn't really make a long-term difference in how things in this country, that generally this country would have been, with the exception of some security measures here and there, that the way we're at each other's throats would have been the same either way. The crime would have been the same either way. I'm not sure that it made any difference long term. Does anyone take issue with that?
I get your point. I mean, the way we travel, some of those things are different, but I guess we are who we are. Is that what you're thinking, Eric?
That's my sense. Yeah, I don't think that it exacerbated the divisiveness in our society, the political divisions, the partisanship, the hatred, all that. I don't think it long term, I don't think it made any difference. There was this great feeling, and Brandon evokes it, which is, I remember 9/12, every house on our block had the American flag flying from it. I'd never seen anything like it. There was a sense that no matter what our political divisions were, we were all united in our horror, in our grief, and our determination on those days. And that just didn't last very long. We were back at each other's throats pretty quickly.
And the whole world did it too. I mean, remember France? They said, we are all Americans today. The whole world was flying the American flag, which is the point of the frontline piece. All that goodwill we had internationally, and then we squandered it over 20 years in Afghanistan.
The legacy I think about, and usually until this year, because of a project I've been working on, I usually would think of the legacy of sort of the endless, aimless war on terror that resulted from 9/11. I was also in fourth grade when 9/11 happened. And I also remember getting news on the way to the bus and hearing all sorts of rumors and crazy misinformation about what actually happened that day. You can only imagine how like 10-year-olds were processing what happened and what they thought about it. But I've been working on this project that I encourage everybody to check out. It's called 20 for 20. If you search 20 for 20 Iron Light Labs on any place you get podcasts, you can find it. And we've been working with this guy, Niels Jorgensen, who was a firefighter for the New York Fire Department for 21 years. He was off duty that day, and he got the call and went basically to the scene of the worst crisis in his life in American history up to that point. And he tells 20 heroic stories for the 20th anniversary. And I've been thinking so much, to Brandon's point, about those individual moments of heroism and how unifying they are for Americans. There was Stephen Siller, who ran through a closed tunnel with 60 pounds of gear on his back to get to the towers and died saving people. Mac Hanna was a construction worker who, with a team of 5 civilians, saved over 50 lives. And Al Bracca, who was a bond broker. He was on the 108th floor of the North Tower, plane struck beneath him. And he led 50 people in prayer before they died. And he stood up on a desk and said, I'm going to see Jesus, who's coming with me. And that stuff really sticks with you more than any sort of political consequence of that day.
How do we find that again?
It's if you search Iron Light Labs or 20 for 20 on podcasts, any place to listen to podcasts, you should find it.
I was in 37th grade.
I had just started as a reporter for the Los Angeles Daily News. So I was living in Los Angeles on my own. And my mom called because, you know, the time difference, she called to say, you know, are you okay? Which is what moms do when things like that happen. And she told me that the White House had been destroyed. The perils of ill-informed first impressions expressions.
Fake news.
Yeah. So I had to go to work. I was sent to Hollywood to interview tourists who were now trapped for forever because, you know, air travel had been shut down. I just finished Reign of Terror by Spencer Ackerman, who is a national security journalist who's written for a bunch of publications, including the Daily Beast. And the main argument of that book is that September 11th did fundamentally change who we were as a country, because it tapped into a part of America that was nativist, that was xenophobic, and that was prejudiced against Muslims. And I think whenever you talk about the great outpouring of unity and sort of feeling like we were all part of this country, I think it excludes the real experiences of Muslim Americans who were targeted, who were harassed, who were, and in some cases, violently attacked and killed. And I think that's important to remember on this anniversary. And Ackerman's argument is that because September 11th, as part of how President Bush responded to the attack, sort of unleashed that anti-Muslim sentiment, that sort of created the environment, the petri dish, if you will, of racism and, like I said, xenophobia that Donald Trump was able to take advantage of in 2016, that rode into the White House and then, of course, led to the insurrection on January 6th. So I think that I don't know that I agree with sort of all of his take, but it was an interesting take that sort of attempted to draw the line with where we are, very divided. This wasn't something that came out of nowhere after September 11th, that it is part and parcel of how we as a country collectively responded to that trauma.
Yeah, and I do have that frontline piece on my mind, and they spoke a little bit about that. And one of the points that they also made was that if you cast yourself as the good and the enemy is evil, then pretty much anything you do can be justified. The end will always justify the means if you're the righteous one. So now you're waterboarding, and now you're doing things that, in fact, they weren't doing, that now we were doing. I thought that was a really sort of cautionary message for all of us Americans. I do believe we're the good guys. Yeah, I still believe that America is good and we are the good a good people. But wow, did we do a lot of bad things in the 20 years since in the name of our goodness. And that's the end of the time we have today, guys. Any last thoughts, recommendations? Brandon, are you jacked about the Bears this season? Are we going to win all of our games? Stuff like that.
You know, I'm pumped to see if we play Justin Fields or not. But yeah, I don't expect a lot of wins. I'll be shocked if they win more than 7 games.
This will be dated instantly almost, but who should the starting quarterback be for the Bears?
Oh, Justin Fields is the most talented. I'd say he should be. If you're going to go off of winning games, you want to win games, play the best quarterback, and that's clearly the rookie.
Austin, do you have any wisdom on the Bears' chances this season? It starts this weekend.
I have no wisdom.
Excellent.
Justin Fields seems like a tremendous quarterback. That's my thought.
Heather, your insight on the Bears. Go.
If the Bears win, I think it will change the conversation over whether they'll stay at Soldier Field.
Zarn, Bears,
it's
go.
It's another mediocre season for the Bears. The Packers win the division. The Bears don't make the playoffs. My recommendation for viewing is Only Murders in the Building on Hulu with Steve Martin and Martin Short.
Is that good? I've seen the trailers for that. Is it fun?
It's fun. Yeah, I think it starts a little slow, but we're 3 episodes in, and I'm liking it. So,
and my comment about the Bears is, have you watched What We Do in the Shadows yet? It's in a 3rd season now. The vampire show? No?
I've
no?
seen 1 episode.
Are you in or out?
I like it.
That's my comment on the Bears. Brandon Pope, thank you for joining. It's as much as I know about the Bears. Eric Zorn, Austin Berg, Heather Cerrone, thank you, guys. That wraps up this edition of The Mincing Rascals, produced by Elif Garris and also by Ashley Byhun. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast. Oh, and by the way, don't forget, Thomas Jefferson. Go to WGNradio.com/TJ. Get your tickets to watch this in person. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Good to see everybody. That was a fun conversation. We didn't talk about COVID for the first time in like...
Wow. Right. Wow, no COVID, yeah.
I know, it's outside time.
Because it's over?
No, because there's nothing more to say. Nothing more to say.
I got a text today from somebody going, please, remember that one time you guys took a day and didn't do it on the radio? Could you please just do it once in a while? No COVID talk.
There you go. All right, bye. See you,
kids.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
So Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.